Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf. You just got back from a good trip, Tony.
And
it's exciting.
Yes.
Where'd you go?
I went to places where my suit coats don't fit quite as well when I come back.
Well, that could be anywhere, really.
Yeah, no, but that's...
anywhere where there's good food.
When you have a pasta course every meal.
Yeah. Sounds like a good problem to have.
It is the right problem to have.
Oh, gosh.
I mean, it's...
And the land of...
The beginning of the year.
Truffles. White truffles.
Well, yeah, that's... Well, that's
exciting.
At the end of the trip, yeah.
That's super exciting. All right.
Yeah, that's never a reasonable thing. I don't find it white truffles that motivating in the States just because... If you go and you can have a crazy experience with them there.
Right. Right.
Oh,
well,
but there's
we
so
can't
many
all
things
do that, Tony. So.
No, but
we can still get very, very good white truffles in the U.S.
You can.
Nothing is like something right out of the ground, though. So, and from its indigenous region where the people have been working with the product for probably thousands of years.
They're generous with it. And that's
they
the
are
thing
generous.
That's cool.
What's so exciting is to, you know, if I can put 10 slices of truffle on a plate, black winter truffle, which are very, very expensive, I'm super, 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 super excited. But if you go to Beaugravier, he's probably going to put like 20 slices on your plate or more. And it's just, ah.
Yeah. Or at Bovio, it's like, she's never going to stop slicing.
So where all did you go in Italy? What regions did you hit?
We were focused on the center of Italy. We're focused on the center and the northwest. So moving from, honestly, landing in Rome, but going immediately into Umbria and to up along Lake Trasimeno, and then to Tuscany, and then Emilia-Romagna, and then the Piedmont. So it's kind of a bit of a broad arc from Rome through Bologna, from Rome through, you know, think Florence to Bologna to Torino, if that's helpful, on this particular trip. And that one of the things that people, I think we often in the States think about Italian food as the entire nation, and you've heard me say it enough times, it's like the Italian food, there are 26 very distinct regions in the country, and the cooking, and you know from having been there enough yourself, is so distinct region by region. It's a remarkable thing. And to be there in the different seasons is a remarkable thing. And for me, it was the first time I've been there this time of the year in the dead of winter.
Oh, wow.
I didn't realize that. And it was cold.
Yeah.
And it was cold. I've almost always been there in spring or fall.
How cold was it?
It never broke freezing the entire time.
Oh, my gosh. So I didn't realize it would be that cold.
We landed in Rome. It was 0 Celsius. And we left Rome. It was 0 Celsius.
Huh.
So it didn't break freezing, I think, the entire time we were there. And it got pretty cold.
Did you have snow?
There was snow in the Piedmont.
Oh, I bet that was beautiful.
You'd started with a reference to white truffles. One of the things that, it's funny, one of the things I was thinking about for this program is what are some of the things that people should really know? One, you don't have to go to Alba to the White Truffle Festival in October to get white truffles. Mm-hmm. That's not the only time.
Sure.
If you do go, if you are lucky enough to travel there, go later. After frost has been serious, they're better. I mean, the people who gather them will tell you, the truffolaie will tell you that the truffles are better and better as you get to the deeper part of the winter. And it's almost like miraculously as Christmas comes along, as that season is around.
That's exciting.
You get the nicest, and then January as well. We had really beautiful ones. So
it's amazing the difference in the way that white truffles taste and smell versus, say, French black winter truffles. I mean, they really are two completely different things.
Yeah, black truffles are a mushroom.
Right.
White truffles are a vegetable.
Right, which is kind of crazy to think about,
but they're both called truffles, they both have that hypnotic aroma.
Mm-hmm.
I swear, in the first night sitting in, I'm going way out of order on our voyage, but
that's okay
since we're on topic with truffles.
Sure.
They were under a glass dome at a very favorite restaurant in Amora in the Barolo zone in Piemonte. The restaurant's called Bovio. And Bovio is a remarkable place to visit. It's a family-owned place. It's been there for a while. It's very established. There's a great, deep and broad wine cellar from the region as well as outside of the region.
The food is amazing. And the view is very pretty from there, too.
Yeah, it's a beautiful.
If it's a nice, clear day.
Regardless of the weather, it's a beautiful place to eat.
It's a great restaurant.
But they, you've seen them. They have a dome, almost like you would think of like a glass cheese dome or something, to keep the truffle smell in on a plate. And it doesn't work. they were behind me, and I knew it.
Sure. The truffle perfume cannot be contained by glass and wood.
Literally, I started twitching, and Lindsay looks at me, and I'm like, I'm high. I swear I'm high. Because what's going on? And she's like, they put the table with the truffles about 2 meters behind you.
Oh, very nice.
I'm like, yeah, I know. Because it's affecting me. I think there's some, this is, I'm not a scientist, but I think there's some chemical compound or something that like invades your spinal cord and your neck and into your brain cortex or something.
I'm like, they are really amazing.
Ay.
I think you almost have to.
I did mean to say cortex and not cortex, by the way.
Okay.
Just thinking about it, I kind of confused myself.
I almost wonder sometimes, too, I would like to sit at a table with people that have never had white truffles. And see what happens when they eat them?
Well, here's a funny one, okay?
Okay.
So at Christmas, you know, I'd gotten that black truffle from you to take home and to eat it. And so Christmas morning for breakfast, and these are magnificent this year.
Oh, my gosh, they're so good.
So Christmas morning
we're talking
for
about
breakfast.
Black winter truffles
from Perigord. You got beautiful ones.
Yeah.
And so I took that nice big fat one, and I took big slices from it, and just put a few grains of sea salt on them. And I'd take day-old baguette and in a heavy bottom pan, just toasted them in butter so they brown nicely.
Slices of baguette.
And while they're still warm, like you drain them for a second, while they're still warm, you put the cold slice of truffle with a little bit of the crunchy salt on it and eat that. And it is a perfect food.
That's a good Christmas morning right there.
Exactly right. That that is great. That's like that's what I want for Christmas morning breakfast.
It smells so good.
Mm. And my three-year-old... She's like, Daddy, something smells funny.
Oh, no.
Woo, woo. And her whole face twitched. So it does have a strong reaction. But I wonder what age and, like, is it not pleasurable until you get past a certain age something?
That's why I said I think it would be interesting to sit people down that, you know, just had never had them. I would be curious if they liked them the first time they had them. I wonder now Well, sure, I agree, but I wonder a little bit even for you and I if it isn't a bit of a learned pleasure, quite frankly. You know, I mean, I remember the first time we had black winter truffles, and I was really excited about it, but I didn't want to eat 25 slices of it. Now I do.
I don't know that.
You had seconds and thirds.
I may be more in touch with that part of my
right. Right. Well, I know for me, I was just like, wow, yeah, these are really, really amazing and good, and I'm so glad I'm eating them. But I don't need to eat more of them. And now I could eat just well. Anyway,
but both the vegetable, the white truffle,
which is
actually related to Jerusalem artichoke, is the closest relative,
and it kind of. In a way, it looks like.
Well, it does look like.
Yeah, it makes so much sense that it's in that family because there is a sense of that. But I mean, the garlic,
if you think about it, there are other bulbs under the ground. Like ginger has incredible flavor and aroma.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Sure.
But that's not remotely like truffle. But I mean, that's, you know, there are a variety of things that grow under the ground that have these remarkable qualities to them. But. Those are the only two things that I can think of that make me twitch.
Well, and then other nice thing about white truffles is you don't feel the need to peel them. With black truffles, I prefer when I go to slice them that I have peeled them. And then I can use the outside for oil or whatever, or I put them in food. I'd finish a sauce with the outside. But if I'm slicing them, I really do like to peel them now. But with white truffles, it's completely unnecessary, which is nice. You know, you can just go right at it.
So, but anyway, The beginning of the conversation was pasta with every course, so with every meal. One of the things that, it's funny, the two things that struck me is I think that people don't necessarily know always how the Italians have a great way of building a meal. And regardless of region, there's one thing that's very universal, even though the cooking is so different. One, Antipasti is something that's before pasta. Makes sense, mm-hmm. right? And almost most of the time it's something cold. Once in a while it's something hot, but a lot of the time it's something cold, and it's something that is meant to like refresh, reinforce, be piquant, be maybe it's spicy, maybe it's crispy, maybe it's sour, the lots of pickled things. Maybe it's salumi, which is Italian charcuterie, which is going to be salty, maybe with, you know, maybe it's salami with an apple from your region or pickled peppers, or it could be very simple things. It could be a salad. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times it is salads or a variety of vegetable dishes that are laid out. But that's, and it just makes you want the pasta more. And that primo, that first, it's funny, that pasta course is called the primo, and that's the first real course. It's kind of funny. They're like, mm-hmm. okay, that wasn't actually real. That was purely...
play.
It was intended to be a tease.
Right.
There's a romance to that menu.
Get you going, right.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. there's... And it might be... And if you're in a region that they grow corn, like in Friuli, it might be a polenta course. It's that starch course. It's... You've been teased. You really, like, you're dying for that start. You're mm-hmm. dying for that first satisfaction, you know? And maybe it's polenta there. Or if it's around the Po River where they grow rice, it might be risotto. It might be a rice course. If you're in the north, it's you know, say you're in Piemonte, it's going to be pasta with remarkable eggs. I mean, the pasta's like glowingly yellow from the yolks. Mm-hmm. Because that's the style of pasta that's made up north. Down south, often the pasta is just water and flour, but you still, like, that's regardless of the region, that's one of those things is going to be what you have. And usually, and it's funny, we don't think of this in the States because we often have soup first. And I think our menus, when we organize a menu, we think about it usually as like a Frenchman does or like an Englishman does, and which kind of makes sense for the original settlement of the country. But soup is often a first course, a first dish. And for the Italians, almost always, it's a primo. It's a first real course. And it's going to be something that's richer than that. Even the lightest of soups, a broth, la minestra, is going to be something that likely has root vegetables, potatoes, something, beans, Hardy. Something satisfying to it.
Sure.
And oftentimes, there'll be pasta in that soup. You know, the one we all know best, in minestrone, you always mm-hmm. think of pasta being in that. So, but that's the functionality of those, you know, that those courses are always, and usually, but not always, usually have a secondo, which is a protein-based course. So that's going to be fish, a meat, a bird, an egg course. That's typically what the way that is built, and then it might be a sweet. But it's kind of like every, you know, it's instead of the orchestra all playing together in one dish, a lot of times that's, you know, you're listening to different sections mm-hmm. at different times playing parts of that piece of music, and the music is drawn out more. And people sit at table for a long time. That's, I mean, in many cultures in Europe especially, they sit at table for a long time.
Which is nice.
But there are gaps between courses, and that's the way it goes.
Yeah. Yeah. You talk. People,
yeah.
You're together.
Well, and you drink.
There's that.
Wine and
stuff.
Wine is part of the meal. That's one thing that, again, I was struck by the way meals are structured. People may have an aperitivo that's something different, and the it might be a beer, and it might be a spirit. Usually not, but it might be a spirit, a Campari or something, or mm-hmm. maybe a vermouth or something like that. And you may have a digestivo afterwards, which is going to be a spirit, a lot of times grappa, or an amaro, which is a bitters. But with the meal, people have wine with the meal. It's part of the meal. It's part of the harmony of it. It's part of digesting it. And that, I think the way that those menus are built, that's the one universal thing, regardless of region, regardless of what the products are. I was thinking, what unifies things is Italian food. Here's a nation that's 100 years younger than we are, as a nation, and we think of it very distinctly as Americans with, you know, Italian emigres coming to the States historically, and many, many Americans of Italian, you know, in their bloodlines. And that's the one universal thing. And our culture is so strong, we've sort of changed the way you think about when you go to an Italian restaurant. Many people will have a pasta as their quote-unquote main course. They don't always have that rhythm. And there is a universal sort of civilization that comes with that rhythm of menu that I think is really quite nice.
Absolutely.
So when we come back on Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine, that's a little more Italian talk, a little far down the menu structure tangent. My apologies. All of that and more on WIPR. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And so I know I took you down the meal structure tangent
that
for
was
a long
fun.
Time.
It was interesting.
We're talking about Italy and universality in Italy and a few, and maybe, you know, the other thing that really struck me, it was interesting for James, who's with me. He has a reasonable concept of Italian wine, but and Lindsay has a very good tasting experience in Italian wine.
Sure.
But I had not had a chance to take them and show them some of the different parts of Tuscany where Sangiovese grows and how incredibly different they are.
Mm-hmm.
And
mean the land?
The land.
Okay.
The what the French call terroir,
mm-hmm.
Spaniards call terruño. You know, that I guess the Italians always referring to zones, you know, and sites and that sort of thing. But the Sangiovese we know, it's funny, the one that people respond to as thinking it's somehow always more upscale is Brunello di Montalcino. Brunello is just the local name for Sangiovese around the town of Montalcino. And that's further south, and that's warmer. And it's honestly, mostly it's flatter as well in Tuscany. And then further east, northeast of there is Montepulciano. And here's where people get confused, because the wine from there, made from Sangiovese, is called Vino Nobile di Montepulciano.
That is confusing.
Because there's a wine in Abruzzo. This is why it's confusing. There's a wine in Abruzzo that is made from the grape Montepulciano.
Oh, boy.
That's right.
Okay.
And people like Montepulciano. It's spicy.
How about we just drink it?
Well, it's spicy and tasty. And like if you like red Zin and like... It's not like Primitivo, but it's usually a pretty good purchase too, for the quality of the wine in the bottle.
Mm-hmm.
And Vino Nobile di Montepulciano is Sangiovese, and it's not as robust and as tannic as Brunello di Montalcino. And the grape there is called Prugnolo Gentile. So okay, Italy, you know, it's all mountains, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's divided for X number of centuries. People never leave their town. So the same thing is different names in different places. So Sangiovese, in most of Italy, and especially in the most famous zone for it, the Chianti zone, and Chianti Classico being the heart of that zone, that area, the nice growing area between Florence and Siena in the middle of Tuscany, that area, it's just referenced as Sangiovese. Around the town of Montalcino, an hour south, it's Brunello. In the town of Montepulciano, which is also a grape name from another region.
Jeez.
It's right. This is why people get confused.
Sure. Understandably
that's
so.
That's why I'm going
Got
slow.
Got it. Right.
And if you give me enough Sangiovese, I'll get confused. The Vino Nobile di Montepulciano is made from Sangiovese, but its name there is Prugnolo Gentile.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, the funny thing is, because now the Chianti zone, it's just the Italian words people know all over the globe. Chianti is one of the three that they all know. They're more likely to recognize Chianti than mozzarella. They're almost as likely to recognize Chianti as pizza, as far as like word recognition.
Okay.
And it's kind of crazy, right?
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that Chianti has a connection with the cheap stuff in the basket that my mother put it on the table.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
We all remember
which wasn't always the greatest quality stuff.
If you're of a certain age,
and
right?
That's, yeah, no, and that's
not the greatest quality.
No.
I remember people used to put candles in them when they were done, right?
They did, and then you stick penny in the candle wax
oh,
as
boy.
It comes down. And,
right.
Yeah.
Lovely.
I had one on the table.
And that's not fair because the wines can be so beautiful.
As a kid, I will admit to having had like a glass, and I was way too young for it, of 1960s Chateau Latour sitting at the table.
Wow.
Right?
What?
Well, not a big glass, but a little glass.
No, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the wine. You had a glass of 1960s Chateau Latour.
My mother was dating a Yugoslavian man who was in the... It's a long story.
Okay.
I grew up in a strange situation. So... Anyway, but my introduction to Italian wine is here. Here's this thing. You stick pennies in it and you put a candle in it, right? And introduction to Chianti is that. And the introduction to French wine is 1960 Chateau Latour, which is not
range.
A great as 61, but it's pretty damn good. The reality of the Chianti zone is, well, we won. Italy taught wine to France. The Romans took the vine from Italy to France. And Chateau Latour has been produced for a couple of hundred years, and has a great history, and it's beautiful wine, and I love it.
Mm-hmm.
The wine from the Chianti zone has been produced for, and with that grape, has been produced for something like 1,550 years.
That's amazing.
That's been documented.
Right.
Which is kind of craziness, right? And so the origins of the wines from the different places are very particular, as they say. But the Chianti Classico, which is the heart of that zone, there's several Chiantis. You may see on a label Chianti Geografico, which is a whole big area and not the best place to grow Sangiovese, except for just really easy consumption. House wine in a very modest house, let's say. And then you see Chianti from two sets of hills, the Colli Senesi, which means the hills near Siena, and Colli Fiorentini, which means the hills near Florence.
Okay.
And those can be, especially in good years, 2015 is a good year, very good purchases. When those wines are released, people should look for them.
So the ones
the 13s are out there, they should look for them.
Florence and
not
Siena.
So strong.
Okay.
But the heart of the zone is the Chianti Classico zone. And those wines, some of them are remarkable. And here's the other thing that's super confusing. This is why Italian wine is this awful thing to figure out. A lot of the best wines from the best estates. And the Chianti Classico zone has all kinds of altitudes to it, steep hillsides, amazing terroirs. I mean, showing these guys this place and seeing how diverse and remarkable the Chianti zone is, they were stunned by the struggle that the vines have in the place, especially in great sites. A grower like San Giusto Rentenano, that is an incredible place, or where Fontori is near Panzano is an incredible place. Those wines, they make wines for very long keeping. But in both of those cases, they make wines that are their most famous and most expensive that are not called Chianti Classico. But they're essentially Chianti Classico. They're made from 100% Sangiovese. One is called Percarlo, and one is called Flationello. Because in the 70s and 80s, the Super Tuscans from the coast went crazy, right? This is why Italian wine is sort of impossible for folks.
Sure. It's complicated. And all these...
And guess what? There are 26 other regions. And within Tuscany alone... This
and it's
is
not
just,
that big of a country.
No, but they grow and they drink
it's
a lot
amazing.
Of wine.
Yeah. Well, sure. Yeah.
I mean, that's...
And the wine is beautiful. But the
function of the menu and the consistency of wine being consumed with it are more consistent there than anywhere else in the world that I can think of.
Mm-hmm.
Or that I've been around or connected to.
Well, it makes sense that they always have wine at the table.
And just trying to figure out just Tuscany alone, and frankly, it's a very large production area, but I was also thinking about with people that they're the three B's that they tend to know that are upscale wines in Italy, right? Brunello, Barolo, and Barbaresco. And so folks will mix them up. Barolo and Barbaresco are all the way up in the northwest of the country, in Piemonte, in the Piedmont. So think north of Genoa, south of Turin, okay, in that part of the country, gigantically different. Or if you're a soccer fan, Juventus country in the northwest, so the big team in Turin. You have to take an area that you're excited about. So I would often tell people that work in the wine shops, like, don't pick the world to become an expert on. Pick one country or one area to become an expert on. Well, if you pick Italy, you start by picking one region. to become an expert on. Learn that region cold. So if you're an Italian wine drinker or you want to learn Italian wine, pick a region and taste consistently in that region, consume consistently in that region. One of the fun things is, as you well know, you can prepare, the recipes are easy to find from different regions of Italy.
Mm-hmm.
Now, compared to even 10 years ago, there's so many regional cookbooks that are now translated into English.
So, yeah, it's a lot better.
Poor James, you know, I give him, he needs a lot of Italian books to just as a refresh on some things. And I give him all these things that are still in Italian. He's like, oh, he found English translations for 8 of the books.
Oh, good. Oh, good.
So, which didn't exist, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago when I found the book. So
that's good.
Yeah. Yeah, he's not interested in looking through Dolomite cooking in German. So
no.
Anyway, but one other thing that was interesting, how much Italians love their bubbles. I was reminded that the section of sparkling wines, we're not always great at celebrating, I think, and we don't always. There are people that the U.S. has gotten very good at wanting a glass of Prosecco. So bravo is what they would say. That's great. But there's so many kinds of sparkling. Every region of Italy makes different sparkling wines, which is sometimes out of red wine, white wines that are a little sweet, like Prosecco, dry wines, sparkling, all kinds of red grapes that are made into white sparkling wines. There's a couple of quick highlights. There's a producer in Emilia-Romagna. Emilia-Romagna is a region that's famous for prosciutto and prosciutto di Parma, and famous for Parmigiano Reggiano, the great cheese, and especially all the filled pastas that you see around Bologna and in the hills. And you also see pasta from chestnut flour up in the forest, in the woods, and some of the mountain restaurants. Emilia-Romagna has the plain of Emilia, but up near Parma, but mostly it has all kinds of mountains. And stopping in one of those old, like been there for a century, family restaurants, I found we had the chestnut flour pasta, we had, you know, the tortellini in brodo, which is very famous, which is essentially pasta filled with mortadella, like bologna from God.
Right.
And Parmigiano and a little breadcrumb into a farce that you then make the tiny tortellini from and have that in an amazing broth. And it was a pork broth. It was obviously made with a pig's foot and had that sweetness and richness to it. It was great. The wine for all of those salty things that they promoted, that they had lots and lots of, as a producer I'd never seen, called Il Poggiolo. And Il Poggiolo is a specialist in sparkling Barbera.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Wow.
Bone dry, served cold.
Did you like it?
I loved it with all of
what
that food.
What you were eating, that food? Okay.
And one of the hardest matches in the world is soup. To have that soup with that salty pasta and have it with that, and nice and hot, but with the cold and refreshing. And we had a plate of mortadella and a plate of other things on the table as well. And also even fried artichokes that were marvelous, and little tiny purple artichokes.
Oh, gosh.
They got from
that.
Somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But those are not an easy match. And that's sparkling Barbera. And there are several different sparkling wines from that region, but that's the thing. Lambrusco is the most famous one. But that's the thing to kind of watch for. And if you want to be geeky about sparkling wine from different places in the world, all the salumi, all the charcuterie that people want to eat, there are a lot of not expensive wines that are red, not strong, sometimes a little bit sweet, sometimes bone dry. They come from Emilia-Romagna that are not Lambrusco. That would be very, very interesting to check out, to play with. And it also sounds like a nice summer something, you know, if you're having like cold supper and you have salty things like it. Frankly, it never occurred to me until I had the artichokes. I'm like, oh, I would have this with fried chicken in a heartbeat. Which maybe sounds crazy, but. And then swinging from there, the other thing that occurred to me wine-wise, in the northwest of Italy, Barolo and Barbaresco, those other two B's that people think of as being important, I think people think of them as being the same. And they're both the same grape. They're both Nebbiolo. But Barbaresco, because it's a little further north and because it's a little bit milder climate in the summer, is never going to have the power, the tannin, that sort of chalkiness that Barolo will. So people who, let's say you're a Pinot Noir drinker and you want to have an appropriate, a properly dimensioned Italian wine for your meal, maybe that's Italian inspired, look for Barbaresco. If you're a drinker who likes Cabernet Sauvignon or things with more power, things with more tannin, more muscle, Barolo is the place to look for that. And you're in a run of very good vintage. This has the other thing that you're pretty safe with from 8 through 15 and probably 16 are pretty strong.
That's nice.
The only thing that looks even remotely weak is 14. And it's not, I mean, having tasted a lot of barrel samples there recently, is not weak. And those wines are not released yet anyway.
Okay.
But yeah, that's one thing. Just Barolo Barbaresco, you're in a very good run of vintages.
That's good. Makes it easy to remember.
It does. And watch that's, and where all of France is lousy in 13, Barolo and Barbaresco make great aged wines in 13.
Good.
So, impressive. Mm-hmm. Well, when we come back on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine, looking forward to a chef's challenge with no truffles. All of that
good.
More on WIPR. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf. So, Tony, where all did you eat on your trip?
Ooh, lots and lots of places. I mean,
What was one of your favorite experiences?
Ah, well, that's...
Let's start there.
Define favorite. Remarkable, notable. Okay, so we went to... We had lunch in the Chianti Classico zone, the town of Panzano. There's what has become a very famous butcher shop.
You ate lunch in a butcher shop or dinner?
Sort of.
Awesome.
There's now dining rooms or restaurant tables connected to this butcher shop. So we walk into the butcher shop. It's your kind of butcher shop. Because we walk in and they're playing AC/DC.
What? Oh,
and
no.
It's like 11:30 in the morning.
Boy.
And there are like 40 people in this butcher shop. And they're eating samples of lardo di colonnella.
Nice.
The pork fat.
Wonderful.
It's been cured.
Yes.
And they're drinking, like little ceramic mugs of Chianti from Panzano. And it's like, okay, and it's loud. I mean, it's crazy. And the butcher, the fellow who's become famous, Dario Cicchini, he comes bursting in, and he is not a small guy. And he has bright red pants on, and he has a mock turtle on, a white mock turtle, and he's got this vest on that's the stripes of the Italian flag, right?
That's awesome.
And
wow.
He comes, and he's got red Crocs on.
All right.
And he comes bursting in, and he knows the fellow who's with me from Fontori.
Oh,
and
good.
He runs over to him and says hello, and the guy that's introduces fun. Me, and we have a brief conversation. And so,
lots of energy. I can
feel
it.
Oh, it's bananas.
That's awesome.
And you know me, I'm like 175 years old. I'm like, this is the least comfortable place in the world. And these guys are like, hey, ciao, 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 just bananas. And the AC/DC is going in the background the whole time. And, there's just all kinds of meat in the case. And guys
That's
are
awesome.
Chopping, things. And there's a giant window full of all the, steer hanging back in the cooler. And
wow.
It's... bananas, right?
Mm-hmm.
We go from there across to one of the dining rooms, and we sit at this big communal table. And the different dining rooms, there's different menus going on for each room. And the menu we're signed up for is the whole animal.
Oh.
So we literally have everything from snout.
Oh, that's awesome. Oh, my
to,
gosh.
There's a course called Rosemary Up the...
Uh-oh.
Okay. So from one end to the other end...
Oh, my gosh.
So that's from one end to the other end of the cow. And there were seven courses of meat, not small, that came out. I mean, the...
Seven
courses of meat.
Oh, my gosh.
They did give us this remarkable... Okay, so you have a little mug, like a coffee mug. That they toss a bunch of dried salt and herbs that's ground up together in
mm-hmm.
there.
Mm-hmm.
And the good olive oil, pour it in there. And there's a big bowl at different spots around this table of vegetables, carrots, celery, fennel, onions.
Cooked or raw?
Raw.
Okay.
And they literally, your vegetable course is you take like a whole carrot that's been peeled and you stick it in, rub it around on that stuff. And you, I'll tell you what, you when you're it. On like course number three of all meat.
Oh, no. Oh, my God.
So, and we had snout, we had neck, we had the fiorentina, the rib chop, you know.
What did they do to the snout?
We had braised.
How did you eat that? Was it braised?
It was cured. It was in
snout.
It was done as a kind of salumi.
Good.
But it was very clear that.
Yeah.
You know.
That's good.
Yeah.
What an experience. That's amazing.
That was pretty nuts. So there was, it was an experience of being overfed is what it was.
And you were drinking with that? You were tasting wine?
Well, we had a couple of bottles of very, very good from Count Clasco.
From his house.
Thank God.
Yeah, right?
Which is the Italian recipe to, like, if you're being overfed, you just drink more wine.
And you said the town's
Panzano.
Panzano. I would say people might want to go there.
Yeah,
I want to go there immediately.
Yeah, if you look up the town of Panzano and Butcher Shop, you're going to see, I'm sure, their site
cool.
and their menus. And
okay.
It's kind of crazy town. You have to be ready for it.
Okay.
And one thing traveling this time of the year, this is not a tourist time of the year, so everyone was Italian everywhere.
That's great.
So if you do go this time of the year, you better speak
Italian.
Italian. Hmm. Not in all the cities, but if you're out in the countryside.
Yeah.
It helps
sure.
a lot.
Of course.
The
of course.
That.
What was one other favorite meal?
Well, the two great restaurants in the Barolo zone, the two family restaurants, one I mentioned early on in the program, Bovio,
mm-hmm.
Is remarkable, and the other one is Trattoria della Posta. And so we tried to, we wanted to try a couple of the exact same courses done by different chefs.
Yeah, that's fun.
You know, in the two restaurants
that's
a little bit differently.
Mm-hmm.
And We spent a lot of time analyzing, eating the heck out of the agnolotti del plin, the kind of like a ravioli. They're little agnolotti, a little square, or not square, really, they're like rectangular bundles, and they kind of get a pinch in the middle. That plin is the pinch. And in the one place, the filling is, you know, we're just trying to break it down, same as you would do.
Sure.
The filling is definitely pork, definitely a little bit of pork liver, but it has that sweetness from that and a lot of sage, no question, garlic and sage. And the other one is definitely mixed meat, so pork, but definitely veal and beef in there as well. And that's what's stronger in that and more garlic and a little bit of pepper.
And this is a fine sure. force meat, right?
Yeah, these are fine force meats inside the,
mm-hmm.
and a little bit of Parmigiano in both.
Mm-hmm.
And finally asked Chef Masolino at Posta, you know, that what kind of chili was he using, because it definitely has a little bit of pop to it. But he also serves it with sugo, which is the sauce, the meat juice, basically.
So what was the pepper that he used?
Black pepper.
Oh.
Isn't that, like, we're trying to
like,
figure
wait.
This great mystery.
Put
and,
down.
No, just fresh cracked. And
okay.
It marinates with the meat.
That's a great
And
restaurant.
Then they grind it. Yeah.
Lovely restaurant. Great cheese cart. Oh my gosh!
Both have great
Woo.
Cheese trolleys. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Those are definitely two of my favorite restaurants.
But those are two. And Bovio is in the town of La Morra. If someone wants to look it up, first word L A, second word M O R R A, and then Trattoria della Posta is in Monforte d'Alba, M O N.
Which is a lovely place.
F O R T E, second word lowercase D apostrophe A L B A.
Great view of the Alps from there.
Yeah, just remarkable.
Beautiful place to be.
Remarkable.
So, Tony, you ready for a chef's challenge?
Here you go.
Oh, my gosh. All right. So
that's right. That was the
my
the
chef's challenge.
The jet stream of my... of my
fresh artichokes.
I apologize for my handwriting.
Cannellini beans, pork.
It's not my strength.
Shank. Pancetta. Pickled sweet and hot peppers. Golden beets. Treviso. Red onion. Fennel. Salt cod. Blood oranges, rosemary, dried marjoram. Mm. I love
mm-hmm.
marjoram. Okay, beans and pork shank and...
And believe it or not, I gave you nothing to make pasta with.
I see. I'm surprised by that, actually. Okay.
But I gave you nothing to make pasta with.
I love the... I want to... Okay, pork shank. That's going to get braised. So I'm going to braise it with the red onions and a little bit of the rosemary. And I know I have red wine and somewhere. So I'll braise the pork shank. And because shank has so much marrow in the bone, it's going to make a beautiful sauce, nice viscosity. And near the end of the cooking of the pork shank, I'm going to cut a couple pieces of the pancetta and crisp it up in the pan. Put a little bit of the fennel in with it, work that together, add that back to the pork shank braising liquid, and put the cannellini beans in and let those cook in there with all that wonderful flavor until they're tender. And then the garnish for that dish. So what will happen is I'll pull the meat off that bone, have the nice tender beans, beautiful sauce, strain the sauce, probably reduce it down a little bit, and I will garnish it with roasted golden beets. The fennel is already in there, so you have some tender fennel for the flavor of those golden beets. Those two things are going to be really pretty together, and that's obviously the entree. And I think with the treviso, I would like to make a salad with the artichokes. So with the treviso, I like to grill it, so cut it in half lengthwise, a little bit of extra virgin olive oil, salt and pepper, super light, and just pop it on the grill for a couple of maybe even 30 to 45 seconds to get color on both sides. And the artichoke, I'm going to thinly slice it and marinate it with the blood orange juice because that's the only acid I have here. So a little bit of blood orange with the artichokes raw. Again, a little bit of oil, salt, and pepper. And I'm going to reserve some of the pancetta so I can do really super thin slices and basically roast it in the oven until it's really crispy. So that salad will have the treviso, the finely sliced artichoke, the crispy pancetta, and I'll use a little bit of the sweet and hot peppers for the dressing for that. The salt cod, just to flake a little bit on top. I think that would be the salt cod with the flavor of the blood orange and the artichoke and the crispy pancetta. I think that would be a really great way to utilize the salt cod. And
salt cod, you're gonna
just flake it. Just
fry it.
Just cook it slowly in a little bit of milk and garlic, and just sort of make it tender and just flake it on top of the salad and dress it well. And then a little bit of marjoram. I don't know what I'm doing with that marjoram, and I really like it. I guess I could have put a little bit of the marjoram in with the pork shank, but those are all the ingredients. So two courses.
Very nice. I feel like I've accomplished something having made you make pork and beans.
Right.
It's like the time I
As
give you hot dogs to work with.
Don't make pork and beans. Oh, well, that was... anyway, yes.
Exactly.
Your turn. Oh,
my turn.
I guess
well,
you I have to give it to you. Here you go.
Yeah, yours was, volante. It's flying challenge. All right. Citrus, radicchio, arugula, eggs, flour, pecorino, mortadella. Okay, prosciutto, ground pork, ground beef, ground veal, butter, extra virgin olive oil, sorted Italian olives, rosemary, sage. All right, what the heck is going on here?
You have all a lot right. of ground meat.
Yeah, I have a lot of ground meat. Let's see. Well, polpetti, if you can use something for a farce, for pasta, because you have the ingredients for pasta. You have the eggs and the flour. And I like to go a little bit yolk-rich if I'm doing a filled pasta and the pasta itself. So you're going to go probably 5 and 2. It's like 5 whole eggs and 2 yolks to go as your measure against the flour. You just need that and salt to make the dough. And you're going to make little thin sheets. And the pork and veal I like together. So the beef, I think I'd reserve the beef. And you have some prosciutto and some mortadella to put into that farce as well. So the farce, if you have some, if there's some Reggiano around and a little bit of the sage, I would marinate that pork and veal with sage. With garlic, if I have any, and with, I guess it's pecorino instead of parmigiano, so I'd have to use the pecorino. But marinate that meat overnight, and then you make the grind with the pecorino, and if you have a little bit of breadcrumb, doesn't hurt either, and the mortadella. And what I want to make are fagottini, which are like little liver-shaped bundles, sort of like It's like a ravioli has like a wiggle to it. It's almost like a mezzo, like a half moon, but has a turn to it. That's nice with that kind of a filling, and easy to do as just a like not steamed, but almost like it's steamed. You just make an oil with more of the sage, and you just have the pasta dry, like on cheesecloth for a second to dry it out. Sprinkle it with a tiny bit of salt, and then the sage oil to kind of dip it into, and you can really taste the flavor of that farce. That would be good. More of the prosciutto, more of the mortadella, make nice salumi. You could also, the treviso or radicchio, either one, they end up being the same. It's easy to make a salad with that guy. I'd rather have an antipasti plate where you just have the radicchio or treviso just like sliced or big leaves, mm-hmm. and you make a quick vinaigrette with extra virgin olive oil and literally it's just oil and citrus. And the citrus, hopefully it's lemon. And just those two things. It's funny, I haven't used any of the butter. Just those two things to dip the leaves into. Prosciutto and mortadella laid out separately. Olives laid out. Rosemary, put it on a vase on the table. Too strong for any of this. I'll use the sage instead. Yeah, I tend to make the meal a little bit simpler. And that ground beef, I'd save it for another application. Or you can make polpetti with it. I mean, you can make, you know, little meatballs. Mm-hmm. But you don't have any stock, so it's kind of it's not as much fun. So much ground meat. So you gave me a lot of work to do, is what you gave me.
It's good for you.
Yeah, it is good for me.
It's nice to have things to work with.
Yeah, no question.
I know when you were talking about using the butter, when I was in culinary school, and in our Italian kitchen at school, one of the things I had never seen before was, you know, of course, we had a big pasta cooker there with all the different baskets and the hot water. And chef would put small metal mixing bowls on top of the back baskets and would melt butter in there. And that's in, you know, each pasta, different one that had its different flavor, whether it was a force meat or it had a cheese filling or whatever. You know, maybe he had butter with sage, fresh sage that we would, you know, it would come out of the basket, you drain it. Into the bowl, toss, and onto the plate. And I think that's a nice way to handle things at home if, you know, you're cooking for your family or having a little party. Yeah, it's just, you know, a little fresh sage and butter, a little cheese and Reggiano or fresh marjoram or rosemary, whatever, and just do a little toss in a metal mixing bowl.
It's an easy way to do it. Anyway, I think that's all we have time for on Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And follow Chef Cindy Wolf on social media.
On Instagram, Chef Wolf. On Twitter, it's Chef Cindy Wolf.
My Instagram is The Real Tony Foreman. And if you want to download this episode or any other podcasts, please go to the WYPR website, take a look at the Foreman Wolf page, and there's all kinds of goodies on there. If you want to correspond with the program, please email us, foremanwolf@wypr.org. Thanks for listening.
And have a great Sunday.